afternoon, and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're live for an hour each weekday afternoon with an open phone line if you'd like to call to raise any question about the Bible or the Christian faith that you'd like to discuss, or if you have a different viewpoint from that of the host, feel free to call to discuss that as well. Now, the lines are full at the moment, but I'm going to give you the number anyway, because if you call in a few minutes, you may very well find a line open. The number is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. And we have a couple of announcements for those in Southern California. One is that on Thursday mornings, and that's tomorrow, early in the morning, we have a Bible study in Temecula at the Panera Bread place, Panera Bread in Temecula, across the street from Costco. That's at 6:30 on Thursday mornings. We're studying through the Gospels and been doing it for some time, but we'd love to have you join us if you're in the area and up early. That's each Thursday, including tomorrow, at 6:30 at Panera Bread in Temecula. The other announcement is that this Saturday, we have a much more rare event. I'm speaking in Buena Park, Orange County, California, at the Way Fellowship. We're going to be talking about the book Song of Solomon. And if you're interested in joining us, that's open to the public, of course. And you can go to our website to find out about the time and the place. The website is thenarrowpath.com. Thenarrowpath.com. Make sure you include the. narrowpath.com, and look under announcements and you'll find all that information. All right, and for those of you interested in the Alaska cruise / Bible school, it's actually going to be a 12-day conference of Christians on a cruise from LA to Alaska, during which I'll be teaching 30 hours through the book of Acts for those who sign up. If you're interested in that cruise, it's coming up in September, and we have both a single man and a single woman both looking for somebody to share a cabin. The cabins are, you pay for the cabin, and assuming there's going to be two people in one, otherwise it costs twice as much. And we have a woman and we have a man both who are looking for somebody to be a roommate if someone else wants to go. So if you're a single guy or a single woman interested in the cruise, there is the possibility of having a roommate, which means, of course, it costs less than if you don't. Anyway, that information is also at thenarrowpath.com, thenarrowpath.com, under announcements. All right, let's go to the phone lines and talk to Crystal, calling from Connecticut. Crystal, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you for taking my call, Steve. I called in before with this question. Basically, I am of Christian faith, Pentecostal, raised, you know, holiness. Without holiness, no man should see God. But I've had a discussion with this is my mom and my aunt, and they are elders of the church. Now, my birthday is coming tomorrow. I'll be 51. So every now and again, you know, I'll have a wine cooler. And I wanted to take a drink for my birthday. And I have a friend that said, he asked it, what did I think God was pleased with me having, drinking. And I said to my friend, well, I think when you asked me to be intimate with you, I think that was a sin. I don't think God was being pleased with that. Me consuming an alcohol drink is not a sin. And so he asked me to talk to the elders of the church, which is my mom and my aunt. And they said what he was saying about defiling the temple. And I kept telling my aunt, but fornication is a sin. If I was to consume alcohol, it is not a sin for me to have consumed an alcohol drink. So she was saying, okay, but read on the scripture about what, you know, she was giving me scriptures of not have strong drink. And she was saying about back then.
So your question would be, is it all right to drink wine, right?
Right. Well, my aunt was making a point of the wine that they had. So she was telling me to do my research in the Greek, and then she was saying the Jews, and then she was saying Latin. I think she said Latin, I think. And she was saying, you'll notice that the grapes and the wine that they drunk is not the same potency, you know, like as if they didn't drink. So
not alcoholic. She's saying it was not alcoholic. Yeah, I've heard Pentecostal people say it because Pentecostals don't believe that drinking alcohol is okay. The fact is that they're just factually mistaken. The Greek word "winos," which is wine, it means wine. It means it's the same word whether you're talking about someone getting drunk with wine or whether you're talking about somebody drinking wine at communion or drinking wine at the Passover or drinking wine at any table. The fact is, if you don't have refrigeration, you have an awful hard time keeping grape juice from becoming wine rather quickly. And in ancient times, they didn't have refrigeration, and they didn't bother to try to keep wine from fermenting. It was actually to their advantage for wine to ferment because they had to add it to their water to make it sanitary. If you don't have alcohol or something like that to put in the water in the third world countries, then the water is often not really potable. It's not really safe to drink. And so throughout the world in ancient times, they would mix wine into their water to make the water drinkable. They wouldn't drink water by itself, generally speaking. And therefore, they had to have alcohol in their wine or else it wouldn't do any good. Now, Jesus drank wine. We know that because he said that he was contrasted from John the Baptist. He said John the Baptist came neither drinking wine or eating bread, and you say he has a demon, but the Son of Man comes eating and drinking, and you say he's a wine bibber and a glutton. That's Matthew chapter 11, verse 18 and 19. Very clearly, he's saying that unlike John the Baptist, who did not drink wine because he was a Nazarite, Jesus does drink wine, and he eats. He did what John the Baptist did not do, in other words. And therefore, he was accused because he was in the wrong crowd. Some of the people in the crowd he was in might have been getting drunk. Of course, Jesus wouldn't be getting drunk. Anyone who thinks that drinking wine is the same thing as getting drunk apparently has only had very limited experience with wine. I've had wine before, and I don't like it. I don't care for wine. I don't drink it for fun at any time. I don't care to drink it, but actually, I've never drunk it and gotten drunk on it. So I mean, there's a difference between drinking wine and getting drunk. Now, the Bible does command us not to be drunk with wine, but there are people who did get drunk, even in the church, even at communion, according to 1 Corinthians 11. Paul said that some people were drinking more of the wine than they should, and they were going home drunk. So obviously the wine had alcohol in it. Where are they going to get wine that doesn't have alcohol in it? Now, if you crush grapes and drink the juice immediately, it'll be unfermented. But they usually didn't do that. They usually brought the whole grape harvest. They juiced it all, and they put it in goatskin bags, and they let it ferment. And they didn't have any way to make it not ferment. So your mom or whoever it was that told you the grapes were different back then, they didn't ferment or something like that. And if she's making a reference to the Latin, I don't know if the Latin would have anything to do with it because the Latin is not the language the Bible is written in. So anyway, I think she believes that what she's saying is true, but she's no doubt been influenced by her denomination, which is the Pentecostal denomination, which has it as one of their doctrines, that you should not ever drink any alcohol. And so she's heard, but she apparently hasn't processed and quite understood a lot of the arguments that they make against it, and she's trying to repeat them, but isn't repeating them quite right. The Pentecostals actually say that the Greek word for wine can mean alcohol wine or non-alcoholic wine. And I think they're mistaken because there's no such thing as non-alcoholic wine in biblical times. Like I said, if you drank the grape juice as soon as the grapes were crushed, it'd be non-alcoholic. But they'd do the whole year's supply of the vintage at one time and store up the wine for the whole year. So they're not going to be drinking it without alcohol in it very much, but they didn't usually drink it straight either. They usually mixed it with water, and it was mainly a way of keeping their water safe to drink. So I think her facts are not quite accurate. Okay, let's talk to Todd from Pennsylvania. Todd, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. This is my fourth time calling. Glad to be on the show. I just wanted to give a quick...
Well, wait, no, we only allow three calls per person, so you'll have to go away.
Timothy Pearson, I think he's the guy that works on your website that has arranged all these phone calls by topic. I think that's he's a big hero of mine. I really appreciate his effort.
Well, now let me tell you this. Timothy Pearson does a lot of work on our website, but the person who's arranged the index of radio shows is actually Jeremy White. He's another guy who volunteers. Tim has put together the YouTube channel, The Narrow Path, and has all the videos and the call of the week and things like that that he's put together. But no, Jeremy White is the name of the guy, and my wife also. And that's the Matthew713.com website that has the indexes. But go ahead.
Well, I certainly appreciate the efforts of all three involved there. I appreciate that. My question is regarding the use of the word all in Romans 3, specifically verses 22 and 23, but it begins in 21. Basically, when Paul says in verse 22, even the righteousness of God through faith in Jesus Christ for all those who believe, I'm reading from the New American Standard, I can understand that the all is constrained by those who believe. He's not talking about everybody has righteousness, but all those who are believers.
Sure.
But the second all, where he says, for there is no distinction, for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. Is there any indication in that second all, where it doesn't seem explicitly limited, that it could refer to the previous all, the believers? Or is he talking about a universal all, every single person without exception? Or is he talking maybe in a hyperbole, like everybody with the exception of, let's say, infants or mentally ill and things like that? And how do we determine, I guess, if it is hyperbole, how do we take a statement that seems like he's speaking in plain speech, literal language, and then jumps into hyperbole? So I guess that's my question, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay. I appreciate your call, Todd. We'll talk about that. In Romans 3, when he says all have sinned and come short of the glory of God, we have to understand this as a summary statement of what he has been leading up to that point. And it began in the beginning of chapter 3 when he was saying that he asked the question, is there any advantage that a Jew has over being a Gentile? That is, there's a Jew and a Gentile. Does one have an advantage over the other? He said, well, yeah, the Jews do have an advantage because they were given more privileges than the Gentiles were. They had, especially, he says, the oracles of God. That is, the scriptures were given to them and were not given initially to the Gentiles. So the Jews have had tremendous advantage. But then he asks in verse 9, what then, are we any better than they? He means, are we Jews any better than the Gentiles? He's just said that the Jews had an advantage that the Gentiles did not have. But have the Jews turned out better than the Gentiles? He says, no, not at all. And then he quotes a bunch of scriptures from the Old Testament to point out, and all of them, by the way, are talking about Jews. He's talking about how you know, sinful some Jews are, at least as sinful as some Gentiles. So he's saying, just because the Jews had advantages that the Gentiles did not have, they did not necessarily turn out better than the Gentiles did. And then he says, for there's no distinction, for all have sinned. Now, no distinction means between the Jew and the Gentile. He's been pointing out, actually, that's been his whole discussion in the first three chapters of Romans, that he's pointing out the Jew and the Gentile are pretty much in the same boat. And this is in the context of a Jewish reader having doubts about that, a Jewish reader thinking that because he's circumcised or because he was raised knowing the law of Moses, that makes him better than a Gentile just by virtue of being a Jew. And Paul's been arguing for three chapters up to this point, no, there is no real better standing that a man has before God for being a Jew than a man who is a Gentile. So when he says there's no distinction, for all have sinned, he means all, Jews and Gentiles. Now, does he mean every man without exception? Well, he could, because, frankly, I don't know that we could find any human being that has not sinned. I don't think there is such a thing as a person who has not sinned. But he's not in using the word all in this particular case. The emphasis is on all races of people, Jews as well as Gentiles, rather than just the Gentiles. Well, all, including the Jews. Jews and Gentiles have sinned. So his argument is that the Jews are not in a class other than the Gentiles being sinners and the Jews not. But both groups are sinners. Now, he does not, in that case, go into the question of whether there's any man on the planet who has never sinned. But that's, I think that if you asked Paul, he would argue the same as Solomon. Solomon said there's no man that lives and has never sinned. And I think that that's an accurate observation. Now, you talk about little children. Obviously, a child is not a man. And Paul is talking about adults here. He's not talking about babies. Some people may wish to make it an anthropomorphic statement rather than a summary statement of argument. And an anthropomorphic statement would be all have sinned would just say all human beings, we might even say from conception, are considered to be sinners. And there are those since the time of Augustine who would say that and would probably read that into what Paul's saying. But Paul's not discussing babies. He's not discussing the mentally incompetent. He's not discussing, a situation where there's, every human being is in view in his statement. He's simply talking about the categories, all categories, Jew and Gentile, all races, Jews and Gentiles, have sinned. And that's what he's arguing against is the idea that the Jews are an exception to that statement as a class. Now, therefore, I don't think that Paul is necessarily thinking in terms of arguing that every human being is a sinner, but I'm pretty sure Paul would have thought that because it's true. I mean, nobody has ever been sinless. Nobody has ever lived without an impure thought, without ever getting angry, without ever envying, without ever being impatient, you know? I mean, it'd be great to think that someone could be born without doing any of those things and live their lifetime, but I don't know anybody who could claim that they have been sinless. So it's a different issue than what Paul is going for. But it would nonetheless be true if we took it in the absolute without exception sense, too. All right, let's talk next to Jana from Irvine, California. Hi, Jana. Good to hear from you.
Hi, Steve. Thank you so much for taking my call, and thank you for what you do.
Sure.
I have two very unrelated questions/desire for your comment.
All right.
One of them is I would just love to hear you comment on what it means to be a child of God, kind of both in terms of John 1:12 and also just kind of the ubiquitous statement, everyone is a child of God. Mm-hmm. You know, created in his image with Imago Dei, that kind of a thing. And my other one, totally unrelated, is if you could comment on Derek Prince and his book, They Shall Expel Demons, if you've ever read that.
Okay.
And I hope to go to your thing on Saturday. Thank you for coming to Orange County.
Great.
And I'm going to take this off the air.
By the way, just by any chance, is this the Jana who's a singer?
Yes.
With a children's ministry?
Yes. In fact, that's kind of what is precipitating this question. Is I was singing a song with kids on at my church, and I was, you might be familiar with this song called Who You Say I Am. I'm a child of God. Yes, I am.
Oh, no, I don't know
and,
that.
I think it's a Hillsong song.
Uh-huh.
But, and this one little guy piped out, we're all children of God. And then another little person said, no, we're not. It was just kind of this funny little, you know, how kids just have a way.
Yeah.
And it was kind of an unanswerable question. I'm sorry.
Okay. Yeah, I'll be glad to discuss that, sure. And if you happen to show up on Saturday night, we'd be glad to meet you.
All right. Thank you again so, so, so very much. You know, it was funny. I turned into your program a few weeks ago, and it was recorded. And actually, one of the calls that was played was an old one of me calling in. And then you recommended your website. And I was like, oh, really? Oh, maybe I'll try that. You've got to be kidding. It must have been so long ago.
That must be ancient, huh?
Yeah. I'm interested.
By the way, you came out to Panera on a Thursday morning once when I wasn't there, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
Yeah. Well, then someone gave me your CDs. I've looked at the DVDs. I liked them. Okay, let me answer your questions if I can. Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to take this off the air. Thank you, Steve.
That's great. Bye. Thanks for calling today. About Derek Prince's book, They Show It's Spelled Demons, I have not read the book, but I am somewhat familiar with Derek Prince's ministry. Back in the 70s, I heard him teach a number of times, once live, and the rest was recorded, lectures or sermons he gave. I don't agree with everything Derek Prince says, but he was mainly, at least in Orange County, he was controversial because he did have what they called a deliverance ministry. Now, back in the early 70s in the charismatic movement, there were a lot of deliverance ministries, and there was a lot of, I think, a lot of nonsense associated with some of it. But the main thing that made it controversial was not even the nonsense, as the whole question of whether a Christian could have a demon or not. Certainly, Chuck Smith, my pastor, was adamant that Christians could not have demons. And so, since I was a teenager when I came under Chuck's influence, I argued the same thing for some years. I became aware that Derek Prince sometimes did cast demons out of people who were Christians or who claimed to be Christians. And that was something that I know that that Chuck was very much against, and Calvary Chapels would be very much against. And I was curious to know, because I was hearing and reading testimonies of people who seemed to have been Christians and seemed to have gotten demons cast out of them. And my initial response was the same as what I've been taught. Well, Christians can't have demons. And I actually was curious enough because I thought, well, if they can, I'd really want to know, just because I wouldn't want to rule out any form of ministry to somebody I might encounter on the assumption that I had a doctrine that eliminated a possibility that could be a real possibility that they might need that. So I read through the Bible looking specifically, over the next 2 years, as I read through the Bible, was looking specifically for verses related to the question of whether Christians can have demons or not. And my conclusion was the Bible does not explicitly say one way or the other. The verses that I could quote right now, which I was taught to argue that a Christian cannot have a demon, for example, greater is he that's in you than he that is in the world. He that is born of God keepeth himself, and the wicked one toucheth him not. What fellowship has light with darkness? What, concord has Christ with Belial, and the rest? Your body is the temple of the Holy Spirit, and so forth. These verses were the proof texts that a Christian could not have a demon. But as I read them in their context, I realized, well, they're not really discussing that. They're talking about something very different than that, and they're not addressing the question that I'm really trying to figure out here. And at the end of my study through the Bible, and I concluded, as I now would conclude, that the Bible does not explicitly say whether a Christian can or cannot have a demon. Now, of course, we often don't even know how to diagnose a problem as demonic. Some people have physical or physiological problems, or we might say psychological problems, which might mimic demon possession and may not be. We also know that some people mimic being Christians and are not really Christians. So it's hard to tell from case studies. And all I can say is that the Bible does not state that a Christian can, and it does not state that a Christian cannot have a demon. And therefore, my position has been ever since the middle of the 70s that if I meet a person who seems to be demon-possessed, I probably should deal with them as a demon-possessed person, whether they claim to be a Christian or not. If they are not really a Christian and are demon-possessed, then I'll be doing them some good. If they are a Christian and are demon-possessed, if that's a possibility, then I would hope I'd be doing them some good, too. So I really can't see what harm would be done. Now, Derek Prince had extensive teachings about casting out demons, as many deliverance ministers do. And by the way, this is not the only thing that Derek Prince taught on. He taught on a great number of things. He was quite a good Bible teacher in many respects, but I had areas of disagreement with him. But I can't say that I've read that particular book, though I've heard him teach about the subject. And I would say some of what he says, I think, is, I would say, speculative or would be an educated guess based on experiences he's had. And, Chuck Smith always said you can't really make any doctrine based on experience because we go by the Word of God. And that's true. But, of course, the Bible doesn't describe everything. And there are things, for example, that we do learn about from experience when the Bible's silent on them. And if experiences do not contradict something in the Word of God, then they may be helpful in learning the facts about something. And so I'm not militant at all against Derek Prince's general teaching on that subject, and I have respected his teachings on other things considerably. So I've got mixed feelings about Derek Prince. Of course, he's gone now. Now, I know you have another question. I'm not going to neglect it. We're going to take a break here. I'll come back to your other question about what it means to be a child of God. At this point, I just have to take a break and let our listeners know that we are listener supported. And if you'd like to help us pay the radio bills, you may. We'll let you. The address is The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730. Temecula, California, 92593. It's also possible to donate from the website, thenarrowpath.com. Now, thenarrowpath.com is a resource. We've got like 1,500 MP3 files of lectures and archives of radio shows. Everything's free there at thenarrowpath.com. So even if you don't want to donate, you should go and benefit from it. I'm going to be back in about 30 seconds, and we've got another half hour ahead of us. Don't go away.
Small is the gate and narrow is the path that leads to life. Welcome to The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. Steve has nothing to sell you, but everything to give you. When today's radio show is over, we invite you to study, learn, and enjoy by visiting thenarrowpath.com, where you'll find free topical audio teachings, blog articles, verse-by-verse teachings, and archives of all The Narrow Path radio shows. We thank you for supporting the listener-supported Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. Remember, thenarrowpath.com.
Welcome back to The Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we are live for another half hour. We're taking calls from listeners all over the place. If you have questions about the Bible or the Christian faith, feel free to give me a call. We'll talk about it. If you have a different view from the host, feel free to call, and we'll talk about that as well. The number to reach me will be, that is, when a line opens up, because the lines are full right now, but in a few minutes, the line will open up, and the number to reach me will be 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. Before the break, I was talking to Jana from Irvine, and she asked a couple of questions. We answered one of them before the break, and the other question was, what does it mean to be a child of God? And in the context particularly of what would you tell children? Is everybody a child of God, or are only Christians children of God? And the answer is yes. That is yes to both questions, but in a different sense. We have to understand that the term child and the term father are used in a variety of ways in the Bible. Of course, when Jesus says, call no man on earth your father, he doesn't mean you can't call your dad father. But he means don't give people the label father as a religious, reverential title. And there's lots of times the word father is used to simply mean somebody who's the founder or the first person to do something. For example, in the list of Cain's descendants in Genesis 4, you know, one of his descendants is the father, said to be the father of all those who live in tents and who herd sheep. Well, certainly not all sheep herders around the world came from that man, but he was the first to do that. Another is said to be the father of those who works with metal and plays musical instruments. Well, obviously it's not the case that people who play musical instruments are all descended from that man. To say he's the father is almost like saying George Washington is the father of our nation. Now, in that context of the various ways that the term father is used and the term son, we find that the term son or child is also used a variety of ways, because it can be so that you are the child of your natural parents. You can also be said to be the child of your age, that is, of your culture, of your nation, or you can be a child in another sense. Now, when Jesus was talking to the children of Abraham in John chapter 8, he said, you know, I know you are Abraham's descendants, but if you were Abraham's children, you would do the works of Abraham. So there he's talking about you can be a descendant, but not a child. Now, of course, a descendant is a child, but or offspring. But the point is, Jesus is using the word child there in a different sense. You may be physically descended from Abraham, but not be very much like Abraham at all. You may not bear the family resemblance in terms of your spiritual orientation or direction. And so if you were really the children of Abraham, you'd be like Abraham. And he said to them in that same context, you're of your father, the devil, the works of your father you want to do. He was a murderer from the beginning, and that's what you want to do. You want to murder me. So he said to them, they were children of the devil, not children of Abraham. And some people have taken that to say, well, everyone then who's not a Christian is a child of the devil. Well, maybe. I mean, but Jesus didn't extend it that way. Jesus said that these murderers were children of the devil because they wanted to murder him, just like the devil was a murderer. Obviously, being a child of means an imitator of somebody who follows the precedent of somebody else, or has the spirit or the a connection with them in that sense. Now, is everyone a child of the devil in that sense? I don't know. I the Bible doesn't say so. Certainly to say the Pharisees, because they wanted to murder Jesus, were rightfully children of their murderous father, Satan. But what about people who aren't Christians, who aren't murderous, aren't the least bit interested in murdering anybody? Would they be said to be children of the devil? Well, some say, well, they're sinners. Well, so am I. I commit sin too, but I'm not a child of the devil. The point here is we need to be careful about words that are used a variety of ways. One thing that's interesting is that when Paul was in Athens, speaking to the Athenian philosophers on Mars Hill, he actually said to them, he says, one of your own philosophers, one of your own poets has said, we are all his children. Now, what's interesting is that the poem, the poet he's quoting is Aratus in a poem that was talking about Zeus's children. In the original quote, it says, for we are all his offspring, meaning Zeus's. But God, Paul was talking about the real God, not Zeus. And he says, but he kind of takes that statement as if, that's got some insight to it. And he says, therefore, since we are all the offspring of God, we ought not to think that the divine nature is of gold and silver and stone. Now, Paul agrees that we're all the offspring of God. Does that mean we're all children of God? Well, in a sense, yes. He's responsible for our existence here. We're born and exist on earth because of him, just like our parents are similarly in that role with us. They brought us into the world, so did God. So in that sense, we're all children of God. And in that sense, even sinners who don't know Christ are beloved of God. And that's what Jesus made clear in the story of the prodigal son. The prodigal son represented the prostitutes and the tax collectors and the sinners that were coming to Jesus. The Pharisees, who were represented by the older son, they were more externally righteous, and they were indignant that God was receiving back these sinners. And Jesus referred to these sinners as if they were prodigal sons coming home. That means that while they were away from their father, they were still children. But they didn't have the benefit of being children. You can be descended from somebody and have no benefit from that. If you're alienated from them, you can be written out of the will, for example. So in a sense, everyone, even the prodigals, are sons of God. But when the Bible says, as many as received him in John 1:12, to them he gave the power to become sons of God. Obviously, that's in a different sense than others. We're all children of God in the sense that, God has brought us all into existence. And he thinks of us as fallen sons. He thinks of us as prodigal sons. He wants us to come home. He wants everyone to be reconciled with him. But not everyone is a son in the sense that they're in the household, that they're in proper relationship with the father. And that sonship comes only with embracing Christ and becoming a Christian and receiving the Spirit of God, which is said to be the spirit of sonship by which we cry out, Abba, Father. So if someone says, well, everybody's a son of God or a child of God, and another person says, no, only Christians are children of God, they're both right in a sense. And both of them would have some scriptural support for what they have to say. And we shouldn't think that contradictory. We just have to understand that being a son of God, in one sense, is not the same thing as being a son of God in another sense. So to say that all people are God's offspring, as Paul said, to my mind, suggests that we are to recognize that God has a heart for all people, just like a father has for his children, even if they're alienated from him. But that doesn't mean they have any benefit from his compassion because they refuse to be in a relationship with him. It's those who come into that proper relationship who are given that spirit of sonship and are adopted in a different sense. And so when the Bible talks about Christians being sons of God, it's a different meaning than it just says everybody is. But that's not too surprising because both the word father and the word son in different contexts in Scripture have very different meanings from each other. And so that would be my answer. The two children, one who said we're all children of God, and the one who said we're not all children of God, they were both right if you understand the terms in different senses. And I think that I don't think either one has to be rebuked. But I would think that probably it should be explained that in a sense, everyone is a child of God. And that can be true if we're not thinking in the same sense as that special way in which Christians are children of God. All right, let's talk to Simone from Pontiac, Michigan. Simone, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks, Steve. I had a question of how Jews today are dealing with the issue of sin and the forgiveness of sin if there's no temple for them to offer sacrifices.
Yeah, I think that the Orthodox Jew would say that it's the way they observe Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, each year, that takes care of that sin problem. Now, they don't offer animal sacrifices because there's no temple to do that in, but they fast. And sometimes there are some Jews who would say, well, because we fast on Yom Kippur, this is what, atones for our sins. Now, I don't know if that's the official position. That's the position I've heard Jews answer. Now, of course, God always did require fasting on Yom Kippur, even in the Old Testament, but the main events of Yom Kippur were not fasting, but a whole bunch of animal sacrifices and the high priest taking the blood into the Holy of Holies and sprinkling it on the mercy seat. That was the main atoning activity of the Day of Atonement, and that isn't done anymore. I mean, you can keep fasting if you want to, but the Bible does not indicate that fasting atones for sin, but that it's the blood. Without the shedding of blood, there's no remission. It says in Leviticus that it's the blood. I've given you the blood as an atonement for sin. So I think that the Jews who do not acknowledge Christ as their atonement are kind of in a hard spot because they can't offer animal sacrifices, the blood they used to offer, nor would it do any good if they could. I mean, you could build the temple again and set up a priesthood and go back and offer animal sacrifices, but it still wouldn't do any good because that system is defunct. God has replaced that system with his own son. The sacrifice of Christ has totally rendered obsolete all the other animal sacrifices. So I think the Jews would look at the observance of Yom Kippur. I'm talking about Orthodox Jews here. Of course, there's more liberal Jews who probably would just say, well, God's too good to care whether we sin or not. He's just an indulgent father. There's a lot of people who would have different answers, even if they're Jewish. But the Jewish religion that is closest, I think, to the religion of the Jews in Jesus' day is what we call Orthodox Judaism. And I believe that Orthodox Jews look, I think they look to their own observance of Torah in general, as well as the Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur, and the fasting they do on that day to cover for them. And in my opinion, their own scriptures would suggest that's not adequate.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you for your call. Daniel from Colorado, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Absolutely. God bless you, Steve.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I'd encourage you to come to Colorado if that's something that you might like to do. I'm sure that there might be several listeners like me that would show up and support.
I don't need to be encouraged. I just need to be invited.
You're now invited. So I'll send you an email
specific.
And see how we could formalize that. But I'd love to see you, and I think others here would as well.
Well, feel free, and I don't require that there be any particular size of crowd. It can be a home meeting, and I don't charge
anything.
Perfect. So that makes it pretty easy.
Yeah, we'd probably go that way with it. So that's fantastic.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll get with you on that. I did want to ask a word question, too, today, the word begotten in John 3:16.
Uh-huh.
I've found that certain versions of the Bible don't even have that word, And I'm embarrassed to tell you, I've glossed over it for many years, and then I started to drill down on it, and I've learned a little bit about it. I haven't had a chance to go to the website and really dig into what your lectures are, but could you talk about that teaching a little bit?
Sure. Yeah, everyone knows John 3:16, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son. The expression only begotten is a single word in the Greek. It's monogenes. And in English, in the King James, it's translated only begotten, because genes, back in 1611, when the King James was translated, they thought genes was related to the word genea, which is to be begotten. And mono means only, one or only. And so monogenes, they thought, should be translated only begotten. And it's only in John's writings, only in the Gospel of John and the Epistles of John, that you actually find this term used of Christ as the monogenes. And so whenever you find in a concordance, for example, in the King James Version, the term only begotten, it's always John using it. Now, Greek scholars have come to understand the Greek language better since 1611, and they've recognized that this is not related to the word for begotten at all. The word monogenes simply has the meaning of unique or one of a kind. Not the idea of being begotten, like a father begets a child, is not necessarily implied in any part of that word in the Greek. It is simply to say he's unique or one of a kind. And so a lot of the modern translations, instead of saying God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son, they'll say he gave his one and only son, which is reflecting the newer understanding, and I think the correct understanding, of the word monogenes. So it's a mistake. It would appear to be a mistake to refer to Jesus as the only begotten son. Now, the Bible does say he's the firstborn of many brethren. It says that in Romans chapter 8 and verse 29, that Christ would be the firstborn of many brethren. And he refers to himself in Revelation, I think it's 1:5 in Revelation, he refers to himself as the firstborn from the dead. And Paul refers to him by that term, too, in Colossians 1:18. Jesus is the firstborn from the dead. He's the firstborn of many sons. But to say he's the only begotten is simply not a term that the Bible uses in the original languages. It's based on an English translation that is generally considered to be deficient.
Well, thank you, Steve. I appreciate that. And, you know, I really appreciate you helping me understand doctrine, which I've had quite a bit in my life, in what's true biblical teaching. And I also appreciate you encouraging me to meditate on the Word. So, again, God bless you. I hope I talk to you again soon. Thank you.
God bless you, Daniel. Thank you so much for your call. I'd be glad to come to Colorado again. I've been there a few times. But, you know, what it takes, for those of you listening, what does it take to get me to come to your area? Very little. It really usually just takes an invitation on a date that I'm not already booked to be somewhere else. And I don't charge for my travels. I don't charge anything, and I don't require a big group. Though it's much more worth my while, of course, to travel if it's not just three or four people. But I actually traveled to, where did I go to? Was it Louisiana? I think Louisiana, years ago, and spent the whole weekend with just like four people or five people, picking my brain for the whole weekend. My time is worth a lot. But to me, a few people are worth a lot, too. So, you know, you can always invite me if you want to, but it helps if there's going to be, you know, a significant number of people who are going to benefit from my coming, since it is a lot of hours flying and so forth in many cases. All right, let's talk to Dylan from Beaverton, Oregon. Welcome to the Narrow Path, Dylan. Dylan, how you doing?
Good. Hi, Steve. So,
hi.
I was challenged by someone the other day. They said, if the only grounds for divorce is sexual immorality, and Jesus said that even if you look at a woman to lust after her, then you've committed adultery in your heart already, is that grounds for divorce?
Well, I think not.
And can I take this offline?
Sure. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, if a man could be divorced by his wife or a wife by her husband, for no other reason than that they had experienced a sexual temptation, you know, in looking at somebody other than their spouse, then no marriage would be safe because, frankly, it's a very general thing for people to be tempted. Now, I don't think Jesus was talking about being tempted. I think he's talking about sinning in your heart. When he said, if you look at a woman to lust after her, that's specifically, intentionally, looking at a woman in order to inflame sexual interest in yourself. That is, your interest in that person. Now, he says, if you're doing that, then you're committing adultery in your heart. Okay, well, what happens in your heart is not punishable in the court of law. You know, Jesus also said, if you're angry at your brother without a cause, it's sort of like murder. But we don't hang people for being angry. I mean, God might. God is the judge of the heart. But external discipline of the law can only be exercised against external behavior because man can only see on the outward appearance and God looks on the heart. So what is done in the heart, that's why I think it's crazy to have a whole category of crimes called hate crimes. I'm not denying that there are people who do crimes out of hate, but law cannot discipline your emotions. Law cannot discipline your motivations. Law can only discipline your actions. If you commit a crime, whether you did it out of hate or out of apathy toward the person's well-being, you've committed the same crime. The person has suffered equally. The damage is done the same. There's no distinction between, in a court of law, there should be no distinction between a crime done out of actual hostility or racial hatred or something like that on the one hand, or the same crime done for any other reason. The truth is the crime is the same, and all that the courts of this land are there to do is to punish criminals for crimes that they commit. Now, God may punish somebody more for a crime of hatred than for a crime of, just carelessness, let's say. But that's God's business. It's God's business to punish crimes of thought and crimes of the heart. It's not man's. And therefore, it's not even mine necessarily to inquire whether my wife ever has a lustful thought toward another person because it's not mine to do anything about. Frankly, if she ever did, I guess I wouldn't be overly surprised because human beings do. Human beings sometimes do. But the other thing is, it's awfully hard to even know when that line has been crossed because sometimes people have sexual lust as a temptation in their heart, but they don't submit to it in their heart. They don't agree to it. And yet it's such a fine line that people often don't know, have I stepped over or not? It'd be crazy to have the stability of a marriage vulnerable to something quite so vague as that. Now, I'm not saying that lust in the heart is not an important thing. Jesus said it was. And, you know, if people are lusting after their neighbor's wives and so forth, they are committing adultery in their heart, and God will judge that. But we don't judge each other. You know, we don't bring physical or criminal penalties against someone for what's in their heart. We shouldn't and mustn't. So Jesus is not indicating that what goes on in the heart is the same thing as fornication. Fornication is a word that had a very general use of any kind of sexual behavior outside of marriage. Ordinarily, the word adultery would be included in fornication. But when Jesus says adultery in the heart, well, that's a different kind of thing. That's not an outward act like fornication is. And therefore, it's, again, punishable by God, but not punishable by man. So, no, it would not be, no case could be made, in my opinion, for divorcing someone on the grounds that they had a lustful thought or committed alleged adultery in their heart. But a person should repent of it if they have done so. Travis from San Diego, California, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling. Travis, are you there?
Yes.
Okay.
How you doing, Steve?
Good.
Yeah, I got a tough question. I'm reading out of 1 Corinthians 6:3. Do you not know that we would judge angels? What do they mean by that? How will we judge angels?
I don't know. I guess we'll just have to find out. We do read in the Bible that there are angels who have fallen and that they are being kept in chains under darkness awaiting the judgment of the last day. This is stated in 2 Peter 2:4 and also in Jude, I think it's verse 6. And so there will be a judgment of the fallen angels. When Paul says that we shall judge angels, I suspect it means that we will be reigning with Christ in the resurrection. And therefore, as he is judging the angels, we will be, you know, co-judging with him. Or maybe he'll just delegate that to us. I don't know. Maybe he'll just say, hey, you guys take care of this. You judge these cases. I don't know. We'll just have to see how that looks. But there are angels that have sinned and are waiting for their judgment. And that judgment will be participants in it, in making decrees concerning their guilt and their punishment, I would assume, from what Paul said. All right? We don't have much time. I need to do as much as I can to get other calls on. There's a caller whose name does not appear, but is from Washington. Hello, caller. What's your name?
Venus.
Venus, welcome.
Thank you. I was just calling, I think it was on Monday, you had said something regarding, like, seeing, you weren't sure if it was the Lord or, like, translucent.
I didn't see it. I didn't see anything. My sister, who was in the room, said she saw something. I heard something.
Oh, oh.
Yeah. Why are you wondering about that? What's your question?
Well, I was just wondering because I did see something like that standing in my doorway. This was many, many, many years ago. And, I at the time I had lost my husband, and it was about a week later. And I had seen something in the doorway, and it looked like it was glowing. It looked kind of translucent. And I was in bed, and when I looked in the doorway, I saw, I think what I could see was, like, looking at me, but I couldn't, you know, really see. And then I closed my eyes, and then when I reopened my eyes, it had turned, and then I closed my eyes and just went to sleep. And, you know, and I mean, to this day, I could still remember I had saw it, you know, and okay. I had mentioned it to a...
So what can I do for you? We don't have much time. What can I do for you?
Oh, I'm sorry. No, I was just, for some reason, I thought you said, but your sister said she had saw it, and I just wanted to say, well, I saw something like that, too, but I guess your sister saw it, not you. I was...
Oh, that's okay. Yeah, there's people all over the world who've seen things and would be, you know, if I put out a general call for people to report, I'm sure I'd get a full hour full of calls of people who've seen things that are similar and had similar experiences.
Now, yeah, I had shared
it. I was not mentioning it in order to make it a focal point. A caller had asked me something about that, and I was trying to explain what it was. Yeah, the story about that is found in my biography at the website at thenarrowpath.com. I appreciate your call. I don't know if I have time. Christy from Whidbey Island, Washington. I'm going to try. We may not have time. Go ahead.
Hi, Steve. I'll be quick. I need help understanding Ham finding Noah naked on the bed and drunk and Canaan being cursed.
Okay. Well, Canaan was cursed unrelated to that event, I think. I don't think Canaan was involved in that. Canaan was cursed because of the wickedness of the Canaanites. But Noah used this occasion to prophesy what would happen to the Canaanites because Canaan was descended from Ham, and Ham showed himself to be something of a scoundrel in this. Now, I won't go into the speculation about what Ham did. Some people think there was something sexual he did. I don't think so. I think he was just being disrespectful to his father. But, the cursing of Canaan is not said to be because of what Ham did. It's just a prophecy that was given on the same occasion. I'd like to go into this more, but I'm totally out of time. I'm sorry to say. You deserve a better answer than that. You've been listening to The Narrow Path. Our website is thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us. God bless you.